I hope you're all keeping well, because this COVID is a very strange time indeed. So not only is it an honour to be asked to do this, but it's a delight as well, because I don't often get asked to talk about my farm in any depth, or my farming, which sounds a little bit strange, but people usually want me to talk about my books and my family and other things. So tonight, I hope you'll forgive me if I just talk about the farm, and yeah, so I'll make a start. So any of you that have read my books will know that I'm a very, in many ways, a very ordinary farm lad with a very ordinary farm background. We're a traditional fell farm in the Lake District. We call it fell. That's really Old Norse. Fjell is Norwegian to this day. It means mountain or sort of upland grazing land. And then I keep hearing about this underfloor heating that you've got in the burn with this limestone that holds the heat. And I think my sheep might like a piece of that. So, and yes, I've got a funny, yes, let's address it head on. I have a very funny life, because I'm also a writer now, but I spend most of my days looking after my sheep and cattle. That's the most important thing in my life. But I also write these books, and I have a sort of second life where people know me for doing that. I'm from a very old farming system, as many of you are, but I'm very lucky to be from this very, very old farming system. It's so old that it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it's an intact system as well. So we have this amazing pastoral landscape where the walls are still there, the outgangs where we go to the fell are still there, the lonnings and lanes that we take sheep to and from the fell are still there, and I've always loved that. Every bit of me's always loved that, really. I love the stories that the old men and women told when I was young. And I was very proud, and from a proud farming family. I wouldn't say the best farming family, but a family just like any other that lived that life. And I grew up very proud of it. And then was a little bit dismayed when I got to school to realize that other people thought this was not quite the thing to do if you're a sort of bright lad or lass, and that you were meant to get out and go to London or Manchester or somewhere fancy and do other things, and this wasn't what you were meant to do. And I rebelled against that and made a mess and wasted my schooling, really, the first time round, because I just wanted to get back to it and to be part of it. My grandfather bred beef shorthorn cattle and dairy shorthorn cattle. Was a good stockman. Stockman's the word that we would use. I don't know if that's the word you use in Ireland for somebody that was known for making a good job of the cattle and sheep and looking after the land well. I think he might have been slightly troublesome individually. He broke out of the family and went off and set off his own farm on a rented farm on the Lowther estate in the north of England. And then in the 1960s, must have been doing quite well, because he bought so he was on a rented farm initially, and then he bought the farm that I now live on in the Lake District Fells. And it was, I don't think it was too posh, it still isn't. It was a sort of hard upland farm at 1,100 feet up. But he could see how we could have just about borrowed the money to afford it. I think we might still be paying that money back, but that's by the by. I thought he was a great man when I was about 10 years old. And then you get a little bit older and you learn about people's imperfections. And I'm not sure he was great in all areas of his life, but he was a great storyteller and a good farmer and a man that spent a lot of time with me when I was a boy. And actually, I would say that to any of you that have young men and women, boys and girls around you, that do your best to show some belief in them, particularly if they're interested in your farms and your farming, because they'll never forget that, and it puts a little bit of pride in you that lasts a long time. Certainly was the effect my grandfather had on me. But this isn't a world that's disappearing. It's a world that tens of thousands of people live in and work in and have enormous pride in what they do and love for what they do. So yes, there's less of them than there was a century ago, but there's still a lot of them doing it. And I grew up being proud to be part of that community, and I still am. I spoke to a historian one day, and he was telling me that the Vikings settled a lot of the landscape where we're at. And there's apparently a line somewhere down the middle of England, not far from the Pennines, where we know that the Vikings that came in from the West had been in Ireland for 50 or so years, because they'd changed the dialect and the spelling of place names. So this is Wasdale. This was settled by Irish Vikings. It sounds daft, that, doesn't it? But it's true. And then if you get sort of several valleys further over, you're into land which was settled from Vikings that had come in from Denmark or northern France or wherever. And this is the mountain and the moorland where we graze our sheep. So we have traditional fell grazing rights to go up there. There's a whole discussion to be had about whether that habitat's as good as it can be. We can come back to that later, but for at least 1,000 years, and we think maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years, people, probably my people, but it doesn't matter whether they're mine or not, people have gone to and from them mountains with the same flocks of sheep. So we think my flock of sheep have been going to and from that mountain for at least 1,000 years and possibly 4,000 or 5,000. There's no way of knowing, but that's how remarkable that system is. And the whole landscape is designed around the coming and going of those sheep. We walk these sheep to and from the fell. We call that a lonning, on the way to and from the fell. And the whole landscape pattern and a lot of the ecology of this landscape's shaped by that grazing. So there's 10 flocks of sheep live on that common land, and they're gathered collectively. So it takes 10 men and women and 25 sheepdogs a couple of days to fetch those sheep down from the fell. And if there's a finer way to spend 2 days than gathering sheep on a fell, I haven't discovered it yet, because it's a remarkable thing and never ceases to make me feel very, very privileged to be part of it. And obviously it's a landscape of the walls and the dogs and the hardy sheep, and be very similar to a lot of your practices. And we have books. We haven't got a lot of literary books in our culture, but we have books. By the way, do you say books or books? So we say books in our dialect. So this is one of the books that you would have. It's the Shepherd's Guide for Our Landscape. And each farm has a different lug mark. Lug doesn't mean here. It sounds like it does, but it means law mark in Viking. And then you have your smit mark, which is your paint mark to say whose sheep belong to who. And some shepherds are like scholars. They know this book inside out, hundreds of pages of it. Others, like me, would just know the sheep on the neighbouring fells. And we know exactly who to return a sheep to. And there's a very strong set of values and ethics about how you behave on a common. You would never claim an unmarked or a white lamb. You would, and you're held to account if you do anything beneath those high standards. And yeah, and for the last 100+ years, we've had the flock books for the breeds that we have. And one of the proudest things that you can do as a shepherd in our landscape is to be celebrated in those flock books for having bred particularly good sheep. I've been fortunate a few times to have bred sheep to go in the flock book. And that's about as immortal as you can get as a shepherd. And most of my shepherding friends will judge me when I get to the end of the road by whether I've bred the kind of sheep that would go into be celebrated in that way. And I hope my literary achievements are a footnote with the shepherds, because I'm one of them and would hope to be respected as such at the end of the day. My father was a very, in the best sense of the word, a very ordinary, decent, hard-working man. Worked on a shearing trailer in the summer, worked in the auction mart as a drover part of the time, did his own farming, was a real grafter, a tremendous fella for working, very well thought of, I think. Even when he was in his 60s, he's about 60-year-old on that photograph, he would be clipping 200-plus sheep a day and giving some of the younger shearers a run for the money. So I'm going to read you a little bit from my book. And I thought I'd read a bit from when I was young, really, from when I was hanging out with my grandfather. One morning, he lifted the wooden hand-carved latch, or sneck, on the stable door. The handle was worn smooth from decades of use by rough farm hands and rose softly above the sneck. The rusty door hinges groaned slightly as he pushed the door open about 4 inches. He peered through the gap, and I pushed beneath his chest to see and feel him tremble with excitement through his coat. "What's happening?" "Shh, keep quiet," he said. "She's falling." The stable was dimly lit by one half-hearted light bulb hanging from a twisted grey electric wire decorated with cobwebs from the beams. The once whitewashed walls were brown with years of cattle shit from their legs and bellies rubbing against them. The cobbled floor was 6 inches deep with white sun-bleached straw. Beneath the dim bulb, the bay mare twisted and turned as if in pain. She was staring at her side, which was swollen, some full limb or other pushing up jagged beneath the taut skin as if she'd swallowed a stepladder. And then she lay down in the straw, and after a minute or so, a contraction shook her whole shivering body like an earthquake. She extended her head out like a corpse and groaned, and Grandad trod carefully towards her rear end, motioning for me to stay where I was. I waited through each contraction, not knowing what was happening. Then she moved a little, and Grandad could see her foal's legs jutting out, strangely long, angular and sharp. He felt past the legs and smiled. The mare shook again and pushed, and the legs seemed to lurch out 4 or 5 inches. He waited for the next tremor and then pulled at the legs. This time they came even further, and her nose was visible, and a flash of white seen through the blood and translucent yellowish birth sac. And then the mare stood up, seesawing to her feet, and the foal clattered down to the straw with a thud that made me wince. My grandfather cleaned its mouth of fluids and leapt to the door before the mare tried to kick him. An hour later, after they'd given her some quiet time, the mare was shaking gently, nervously, as the foal prodded her side with its head, looking for a teat. A week later, the foal was running around the field, learning to use its two big legs and snorting defiantly as Grandad watched it from the field gate. Grandad was still a horseman, 40 years after he'd bought his first tractor. So it's not all about me. I'm from a very long line of people that did the same things that I do, and I delight in that and glory in it. I think life's bigger than any of us, isn't it, really? And my farming pride and joy is my flock of Herdwick sheep. I'm everything more of them than anybody else, but I think they're tremendous. I think they look like peas in a pod, and it's taken me 20 years. I inherited a good flock from a neighbour, and I've worked very hard on getting them just how I want them. And if you can't tell them sheep apart, I'm delighted, because I want a flock of sheep that's consistent and all of the same type. And that's what we care about greatly. And they have to be practical and hardy. I've got, increasingly as I get older, I've got less and less time for silly breeds of things and things that require too much looking after, false looking after. So these sheep can live in minus 15, minus 20, and they're remarkably tough. And in the last few years, we've gone back into cattle. We were a sheep farm for a long time, perhaps too long. The more I learn about good grazing and good land management, the more I think we need a diversity of animals. So we've gone into belted Galloway cattle, and perhaps some of you breed them as well. I know there's a lot of good breeders in Ireland. And love working with my dogs. So we have Border Collie dogs. We just have another with a pup at the moment that we've just got. And I enjoy trying to train them. So I just actually lost the middle dog 2 months ago, Tanny. He was a tremendous dog, a real athlete. And he just got to an age and he burned out and disappeared. And well, went down quite quickly. We thought the world of him. So that paints a bit of a picture of who I am and where I'm from. But the sad truth is we're living in this broken age, aren't we? Where we're learning all sorts of sad truths on a day-to-day basis about, particularly about what's happened to nature. And I think any of us that are prepared to be honest know that we've all played a part in that, and our families have played a part in that. And in some ways, it's ironic and sad, because in some ways we've become too good a farmers. If by good farmer you mean produce one hell of a lot of stuff very cheaply. And we're, unfortunately, and I didn't like it when I first began to learn about it years ago, and I'm sure many of you didn't. When you first begin to learn that farming is fingered with the blame for quite a lot of that, that our land use is inevitably having these huge effects, that's a difficult thing to swallow, and a difficult thing to digest and to think about how we might do something different. It's not an easy thing to get your head around. And certainly in the pastoral bits of Britain and Ireland, it's not a secret to many of us what's happened, because we've lived through it, haven't we? And my book was about that. So we've gone from these landscapes that were patchworks with lots of different things happening in them, managed and grazed in different ways, and lots of niches for different things, to a sort of simplified, stripped away landscape where there's far less places for nature. So the question that came to obsess me over the last 10 or 15 years, and many of you I'm sure, is what can we do about it? Do we bury our heads in the sand or be defiant and say it's nothing to do with us or nothing can be done? Or do we do the best we can to try and make things better? And I've come to the conclusion, and I've read an enormous amount of books about ecology, and I've had all sorts of ecologists and environmentalists come to my farm. I've come to the conclusion that there's three questions we probably have to start asking ourselves on farms. The first one is, what was this place before we wrecked it, I suppose, or spoiled it or changed it? And so I think we need some kind of understanding of what the native habitats were and the native processes, natural processes. What were the habitats that existed before we changed it all? And have we gone too far? And what were the natural processes that made it tick? And I think that's very interesting, because once you've got your head around understanding those things, and they'll be different in the Burren perhaps than in the Lake District, you can start to do something about it. So the question I'm trying to answer through my farming now as best I can, and that might be imperfect, is how can we recreate at least some of that on our farm, the habitats and the processes? So I'll give you an aerial view of the farm here. This is the 40-something odd fields that we have on our farm. That's about a third more fields than we had when I was maybe 25 years old. There'd been a stripping away of in our landscape. You can see there was a lot of old hedgerows. and they'd slowly disappeared. There was a lot of woodland and that had shrunk and disappeared over time. And there was a gradual intensification of how you farmed grass and a gradual loss of a lot of the craftsmanship in the hedgerows and other things that had kept the biodiversity there. And we were ending up with these big lumps of land that were set stocking basically with sheep. And you fool yourself that you're doing exactly what your grandfather or his grandfather did. And then when you start to look at it, you think, hang on a minute, there's a lot of hedgerows in the past that aren't there anymore. There's just the remnants of them left. So there's been this stripping away taking place. The fell behind, the mountain behind, isn't farmed by us. It's a piece of land managed by another farmer that belongs to the National Trust. And it's part of a, I'm not sure how effective it is, but it's part of a rewilding project where they're letting the natural habitats come back. I live in the stone barn there, and that's our farm buildings in the background. We have 185 acres that we own, another 100 or so acres that we graze for other people at different times of the year. We run about 600 sheep, 300 ewes and followers, but a simpler way of putting that. And then we run about 15-20 cattle. They're just building up at the moment. And it was a patchwork. You can see a hell of a lot of new fence posts in there, because that's a lot of the work we've done has been A, putting back in the 18th century patchwork of hedgerows and mixed habitats and small fields, and then B, putting in things that haven't existed or maybe never existed for a very long time. Things like these river riparian habitats and corridors. We've planted 6,000 trees when we started in 2012, and I think we're up to about 15,000 trees since. So we're trying to put back in the woodland. That's one of the obvious things you can do. Not abandoned. We do some rough grazing of cattle in those woodlands. We've had some pigs in there actually this summer. But that gives you an example of how we can start to put some of that woodland back into there. And we're getting grazing over the fences as that spreads out with the cattle and sheep. And we're thinking about shelter and leaf matter. And also, I'll come back onto it in a minute, but we're able to manage our grazing much better when we get back in those little fields. This is a landscape where it can rain and be cold and wet for 6 months of the year. Tough old place. And we get a lot of flooding. We're in the Eden Valley. Some of you that follow the news will know that Carlisle's been flooded twice, had record floods twice downstream from us in the last 15 years. I think in the previous 100 years, they never once broke the record on the bridge down there. That record's been broken twice in about 10 years with devastating floods. And the belief amongst the people that know about rivers and flooding is that we've done such a good job of draining this landscape. It's a huge area of, the catchment is a huge area of the north of England, that the flooding, peak flooding gets to the city about an hour faster than it used to. Doesn't help that the city's been expanded into the floodplain and all sorts of other issues, but there's clearly an issue with land management and how we hold on to water high up in the catchment. And again, I didn't like that when I first learned about it 20 years ago, but you grow up and get your head around it and realise that you have to play your part. Yeah, we do a lot of work with the river trusts. We can make our habitat much better for the salmon and sea trout that come up our, we call them becks, streams. So we're working on that. The corridors we planted and fenced off in 2012 with the river trust, we were slow converts. And I write about that in the book. We did it really because we were trying to put the farm back together and we were short of money to fence it. So when very clever River Trust people came and said, we'll do a deal with you, we'll do the fencing if you give up some of the key bits of habitat that we want, we went along with that. And then we discovered we rather liked it. And a lot of good things happened in those spaces. And what we saw very, very quickly was nature come back when we gave it a chance. That's the long and the short of it. So a farm that had been more or less set stocked and permanently short grazed, suddenly you have these areas and you can see way more insects than you've seen before. Within 6 months of fencing off some of those areas, the barn owl came back to our farm after 10 or 15 years of being away. And we all stood and looked at this barn owl one night over some of our fields, and everybody had I looked around and everybody in my family had a smile on their face. And it didn't have to be said, but I could tell what everybody was thinking. We don't have to be the bad guys. We can put a lot of this stuff back together and it can make our lives better. It's beautiful and it's good. And we can play a part in making things better. And since then, we've got braver and braver and less recalcitrant, if that's a word. And we've started to get really into trying to put the nature back into our farm. So I've got clumps of thistles on my farm. Up until about 10 years ago, I'd have been out with the knapsack and some spray, and I got rid of them. But you see, if you can just make some spaces around the edges or in the rougher bits of the farm, you get amazing clouds of butterflies this summer we've had, and just everything needs a chance, don't we? And we've been too good at tidying up, too good at making things everything perfect. My real passion now is, I was looking at some of those habitats we've created around the fields with a friend of mine that's a botanist a few years ago, and he said, you think nature's in the edge bits, don't you? And I said, yeah, they were proud of them. He said, you're wrong, nature's in the fields. And he did a botanical survey, and we had 100 or more species of plants, wildflowers and grasses in our meadows. We had nearly 100 in some of our cattle pastures, and we're between 40 and 60 in our sheep pastures. And he said, no, you need to start thinking about the fields themselves as generating biomass and biodiversity. And in the last 5 years, I've become obsessed with soil. It's amazing stuff. This is amazing stuff that keeps us. You look after this properly, it looks after you properly as a farmer. So I'm obsessed with soil. So what are we doing? We've had to teach ourselves, with the help of various experts, to graze much longer grass than we used to. You'll see there, I've turned a little bit over. So we're grazing, particularly in the peak growing season, we're grazing much longer. We're staying out for much longer, trying to do at least 2 45 or 50 day breaks in grazing in the peak growing season, or 190 day break. And you get these really long swards, probably too long for a lot of sheep. And then we're mob grazing them as fast as we can and trampling as much on the surface, particularly in summer. And then you're getting this amazing thatch, and you're seeing, I go back up, the transformation in our soil, the dark sort of humusy soil is amazing, sort of loamy, rich, dark soil, very, very quickly improving. Obsessed with earthworms, get yourself a spade, get out in your fields if you're not already doing this. The other fantastic thing is, so how many spades can you count in an earthworm in a spade full of soil is a fantastic measure. Another is how many birds you see in your field. And maybe the best of the whole lot is to feel whether the ground gives under your feet. Really good, healthy soil gives about half an inch or an inch under your foot as you're walking across your fields. And I get massive delight out of that. It's because it's healthy and aerated. And we're using the livestock to do that. There's a lot of talk about sort of anti-livestock talk. Let's be honest about it. There are things you can do with livestock. There are things you can feed livestock that are ecologically disastrous. But there's ways you can farm livestock that are fantastic for soil, fantastic for biodiversity. So we're using these ladies that I'm every bit as passionate about as I ever was. And we're using them in a long break rotational grazing regime. Particularly in summer, that's having a transformational effect on our farm. And we're using the cattle as well, and that's what it looks like in the middle of summer. My granddad would have said I was wasting grass, but then my granddad didn't know about feeding the soil with organic matter on the surface. And muck, piss, saliva, trampling, that's the stuff that feeds your soil. To hell with synthetic fertilizers, to hell with paying corporations lots of money. Let's farm like farming should be done, where we look after the soil and we use natural processes. And what we're seeing by doing that is that, and we're getting away from as many chemicals as we can, minimizing the use of them. What we're seeing is explosions of insect life in the dung. We're getting dung beetles everywhere on the farm. Nothing I like to see more now. That's the whole of a dung beetle. I hope you're not having your suppers. And fungi, I want to see fungi everywhere, because when we get that dead thatch on the top of the soil, we know that we're getting our soil healthy again. And I can maybe share this presentation afterwards, but what we're finding, and don't worry about these numbers, is within 2 to 3 years, we can put 2% soil organic matter percentage increase on our soil. And that's having a remarkable effect on our land just by that different grazing regime, just by using photosynthesis more effectively and using the cattle and sheep more effectively. And there's a way to go. I think we can get 4 or 5% at least extra organic matter in our soil. So they're peaty soils. They run at about 15% organic matter when they're set stocked for a long time. I think we can get them to 17, 18, maybe 19%. So yes, how have we done this? We've done this by being in every flipping environmental sun. And yes, they're an absolute pain in the backside. It's wildly bureaucratic. It's an absolute pain. I keep getting snotty emails from the government agency telling me that I've broke done some minor infringement of some bureaucratic rule, and I'm just going to do the best I can and keep going through it. But it has helped to try and put that patchwork back into our landscape. And what do we need in these landscapes? If we're going to look after them properly, we need proper boundaries, we need proper farming people, we need proper craft skills like walling and hedging and all that stuff that makes our landscapes and our communities work. We don't let anybody retire in these valleys. We work them to death rigorously. And I love to see now on my farm diversity, because the more we learn about how to keep animals healthy and how we stay healthy by eating the right kind of food, is that we need this diversity of plants. So I want my fields to be full of flowers. I know many of yours are, because I'm a competitive little boy. I want my hemiders to, before I die, to be the best in the Lake District. We're up to about 105 species in them at the moment. There's still work to be done. We've just put 6,500 new plug plants in with rarer plants just to get them better. I am as proud of those flowers as any of my livestock these days. And I want to see spiders, and I want to see longer vegetation. I want to have areas of the farm set aside where we can, for much longer periods, where we can get really fantastic other plants, wetland plants and other things. That's the kind of thing we're looking for on part of the farm, just these banks of flowers and diversity. My hot tip is make friends with ecologists and people that know about stuff you don't know about. There's no shame in not knowing about moths or flowers or anything else. Find people who are into that stuff, get them on your farm and get them to teach you, because it makes life richer. When I walk around the farm, I want to see the base layer of our food pyramid really, really rich. I want to see lots of voles. I want to see lots of frogs. I want to see lots of caterpillars in summer. I want to see lots of fungi. And what we're trying to do is to mix it all up. So talking about those natural processes, we've just brought pigs onto the farm in the last year, just a small number, but we're using them to mix things up in the woodland and the nature areas, get that dynamism that you would have had from wild boars and other things. But it all comes back to having the people here, the people that love their livestock and love their land. We can do remarkable things when we get ourselves in the right place mentally. I'm as proud of my Herdwick sheep as I've ever been, probably more so. I can fit them into this kind of patchwork landscape if we build it. And that's the sort of thing I'm aiming for. I want a landscape where I can graze these very special sheep. I can move them on within 3 days to another pasture. And we can have all the nature around us. I don't want to be one of the bad guys, and I'm sure you don't. I want to be part of the solutions. We're doing this thing on our farm where we keep identifying the least productive bit of the farm. And then we're saying, all right, what's the best thing we could do for nature on that place? So bear in mind, it's costing us nearly nothing in terms of productivity. And then we're turning a boggy bit into a series of ponds. Amazing, absolutely amazing habitats that we're starting to create. Am I paying for all of this with a magic money tree or by writing books? No, I'm doing this by working really closely with environmental organizations and charities. And they're coming to the farm with the money. And I'm saying, all right, here's this thing we can do. What do you think? And they're coming up with their own ideas and forcing me to go further. And it's good. It's exciting. About a month ago, 3 months ago, we saw little egrets back in our valley for the first time. Never, ever seen them before on our farm. Amazing. And everybody stood with their mouths open again and said, wow, this is it. This is what we're all about. Let's get it done. We've re-wetted a lot of the peat bogs on our fell with sort of buns to hold the water on to stop the 19th century drainage. We're farming the cattle around these little paddocks, around these ponds that we've built. Nearly done. Don't worry, organisers, I'm nearly off. And we're planting trees left, right and centre, and we're doing them as shelter belts, and we're doing them on the edge of the farm, and we're using them as to widen the gap from us from our neighbours so that we can run a closed herd and a closed flock without touching noses so that we reduce transmission of diseases. And we just want to do it. So I think shelter in the wind is just like buying feed. Might as well have shelter. And we're doing a lot of traditional craft things like laying the hedgerows. All around the farm, laying those hedgerows. We have school visits. Our environmental scheme encourages us to have school visits, so we try and bring them on the farm, and they help us plant trees. What gets me out of bed in the morning? My Herdwick sheep. They'll always be my passion. They're my great love, but it doesn't mean... There's a sort of idea you can't be a livestock farmer and you can't love nature. It's the biggest load of rubbish I've ever heard. You can be both. Many of you will be both, and I believe in that too. We can do this. You can do it and I can do it, and we can make things better if we can persuade the public to back us and the politicians to back us. You love your land, I'm sure you do, and I love mine, and we can put it back together. And the public want this. The vast majority of the British, the Irish public, they want their landscapes looked after properly. They want good food. They don't want to be relying on processed rubbish that comes from America and a bunch of nasty corporations. So yes, I did write a book about all of this called English Pastoral. It's a memoir. It's as good effort as I could manage. And it tells the story of my family over those three generations. But I'm going to say a huge thank you to all of you. I'm a huge admirer of what you do. Please keep going with it. Please work with your organisers and your leaders to get these schemes in place. And I hope to come and visit you someday. Thank you very much.